Tommy Graham. Tell me if you can hear this on the audio, Tommy. Send me an email.
Bylaws in a more substantive and interesting sense. There's a lot of issues about what we should do, how we do it, the Markle Foundation money that we received and how we're going to use it, and so forth. And Greg Crew is going to be leading this session.
Thank you, Esther. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. One of the very first acts of the board at its first board meeting in Boston last year was to move forward with the establishment of a membership that would place 9 elected directors on the board and to replace the initial directors as we were at that time. We formed a membership advisory committee which worked very hard for quite a few months on developing the principles and some of the practices that should go into the establishment of a membership. Following that and the resolutions of the board in San Diego, the staff have put together a set of bylaws under Article 2, which in fact establish the principles under which the membership should be established and in which the at-large council should be formed and the at-large directors should be seated. Perhaps if I make a brief presentation with a number of slides just to summarise the situation that we now have. Ben, have you got the first slide there? Thanks. We just move on from the title page. The principles that the board has established are that members for at-large purposes should be individuals with no other constraints. And in fact, this is intended that anyone worldwide with an interest in the internet can become a member in the activities of the at-large constituency. The question of the costs of this operation was a key issue, and the board arrived at a principle that the costs of this should be primarily borne by the members. Fortunately, we have, as you now know, had a grant to start the process from the Michael Foundation, not only in the form of funds, but in the form of cooperation from some very notable organisations to assist us in designing and in evaluating an election process, and Andrew McLaughlin will say a little more about this later. In enrolling members, we see two classes of data required. Members must provide their name and address, the address being the way in which we confirm their residency status, which is a part of the process for achieving geographic diversity. They must provide an email address for online communications, and they must also agree to comply with the bylaws of the corporation. We would also propose to seek voluntary information for statistical purposes. This would be entirely voluntary, but it would be useful to know who makes up the membership in statistical terms, I'm sure you'd agree. Another principle that the Membership Advisory Committee established was that the membership should be reviewed or renewed after each election, the purpose being to purge the membership list of inactive members so that members would enrol and after each election the list would be terminated and the members would be invited to reapply. We also need to close the membership list 30 days before elections are held. This is quite normal in all electioneering practices, to make sure that the list is complete, that there is certainty about who is and who is not on the list, and that there is time for an exchange of correspondence online during the election process. The next slide. The at-large council will be elected by the members, and it will consist of 18 members with two members per region elected by the residents of each region, and the candidates for the council must be citizens of the region that they would represent, plus 8 global, that is 8 of the at-large council members would be elected by all of the members voting as a single constituency. The board also decided that there should be a phased establishment to test and evaluate the process to make sure that it was working satisfactorily before the final council was seated. And so the intention is that as soon as we have a reasonable electorate, reasonably representative of the global internet community, and we've set a number of 5,000 members on that, we would have an election for 6 at-large council members who would seat or select 3 at-large directors. Once the process was deemed to be a satisfactory one, we would go into a second phase election in which the remaining 12 at-large council members would be elected, and then they would seat the remaining 6 at-large directors. it was agreed that members of the at-large council can nominate for director, but must stand down when they did so that they did not take any further part in the process. I've added in italics there, not in their first year. This is something that when one looks at it, particularly for the first six at-large council members who are going to select the first three directors, if they all nominated and all stood down, we wouldn't have a council to go forward. So I think there should be some restriction on when the council members can stand, and I would recommend that that be not in their first year. The geographic diversity has been a key requirement in this process, and we've sought to achieve that, as I've said, by the representation on the council, and of course the directors of the council select have to comply with the diversity requirements of the bylaws, which are quite clear. Next slide, please, Ben. We are now standing at a point in time where the bylaws have been written. We have had a grant offered by the Markle Foundation, and so we can go forward from November 1999. What has to be done here is that we need to recruit a staff member that can manage the process for us, the process being the preparation of a specification which embodies the process of electing, of recruiting and enrolling members and electing councillors, and put in place an online system that will enable this to happen. That is going to take some time, and I think an optimistic timetable for the system to be ready would be February of next year, whereupon we could solicit applications for membership. The view being that until we are able to capture members on a membership roll, there is little point in having a large campaign, although some initial work has already started and will continue to stimulate interest. At a point in time, we would have sufficient members to for the board to believe that an election or the first election could proceed, and if one assumes that that takes say 2 months, by April we would close the membership list and go through the process of calling for nominations for the council, allow the nominees to post up on a website comments on their eligibility for the council and the approach that they would take as council members so that members can make a decision. There would be an election, so that by June we would hope to have elected six council members, and that the elected council members would have selected three members of the board. At that point, following a review of the process, the membership enrolment would be reopened, and the process would continue towards electing the next set of council members, and finally the nine board members. The next slide, please, Ben. We've lost it. Is it? Oh, thank you. Okay, so that I should have read my own slides. If one looks at this, it should be possible to have all of the nine selected at-large directors seated by September, which is, of course, our objective. But it is a very tight timetable that requires action to start immediately on finding a staff member, going into the process of finding a system, commencing an outreach program to enrol members, and going through a process which will be monitored and reviewed as it proceeds. I think at this stage I might invite Andrew to comment on the Markle Foundation grant and how that will affect the process.
Meg or somebody, can I have you just follow, get a web browser up there and follow along with me? Can you go to the iCandle page? At-large membership under resources, and then click on the Markle Foundation grant. Thanks. What I'm going to do is in part to report to the ICANN community about what it was that Markle agreed to fund, and also in part to sort of set the stage, because it presents a convenient way for me to describe status of our structure. I'm going to give some background about the Markle Foundation's grant, what it stands for, and how we got here, and then I'll try to do that very briefly because I know that there's a lot of room for comment on this. Following up on the board's San Diego resolution, the ICANN staff put together a foundation grant proposal, which was put out on the web and also sent to a number of other potentially interested parties. The party that was most interested and that ultimately followed up on it was the Markle Foundation. So you'll see that this is targeted towards this particular foundation. If you can scroll down to the background section, this is free. Let me just briefly run through how we got here. The white paper provided that the new corporation, which eventually was recognized as ICANN, should have a membership structure to elect a board of directors and to do so as part of an effort to have accountability from the ICANN community at large. Now that I'm in control, I can't really see what I'm in control of. There we go. All right, the image is now perfect. No further discussion. And the Department of Commerce and ICANN's Memorandum of Understanding required that ICANN and the DOC collaborate on the design, development, and testing of appropriate membership mechanisms that foster accountability to and representation of the global and functional diversity of the Internet as users within the structure of the private sector DNS management organization. So it's part of our MOU. It's one of the things that the ICANN board has spent the most time on in the past year. ICANN has had a membership advisory committee, which produced a final report. We have commissioned a report from the Berkman Center called Representation Cyberspace Study, and I know that some of the MAC members are going to be making a presentation later, so I won't get into that in any great detail. And then, so to cut to the chase, Greg has described the structure and the timetable for implementing it. The Markle Foundation grant proposal is going to pay for 8 different things. One, it sets aside $30,000 to fund 6 months of a membership program manager. Having produced this report or the application, I actually have some qualms about whether $30,000, a $60,000 annual rate, is going to be enough money. One of the things that we may be doing is going back to the Markle Foundation and tinkering with these numbers a little bit to allow us to hire somebody. In the Los Angeles area and in this economy, it turns out to be very hard to hire people. ICANN has had some difficulty finding people for the jobs that we have posted, and a lot of that is because we're a nonprofit and pay nonprofit salaries, and people with good technical and program management skills are hard to come by. The second thing it pays for is a technical services contract for the design, development, installation, and testing of membership computer applications. We envision that we're going to outsource that function. Three is to purchase membership computer software, server, and network interface. We set aside $15,000 for that. That should be plenty. Number four is professional services to assist with the design and coordination of at-large membership outreach program element. And again, here we're envisioning contracting with some sort of an outside party to do what amounts to a marketing campaign. Number five is travel and miscellaneous out-of-pocket expenses. And that was the total minimum budget that we thought was necessary to get us to some kind of a plausible membership structure, $100,000. We also said, look, if you want to help us to do it right and to do it in a more thorough and comprehensive way globally, there are three other things you can give us money for. One is professional services and educational materials for expanded global outreach, recruitment, and public awareness program. This is basically a $50,000 chunk that's to supplement the things that are listed above, focusing on outreach. Number 7 is funds to attract matching in-kind donations of internet portal advertising space, public service announcements, etc. This was something the Marco Foundation was very interested in doing. They like to leverage their grants. They were interested in attracting tangible in-kind support from web portals and other companies that have access to heavy traffic. Finally, number 8 is the translation of key at-large membership documents, brochures, web pages, etc. into major languages. That's a significant. I don't know how much translation $25,000 is going to buy, and I don't know how many languages, major languages, is going to turn out to be. But what I'm hoping that we can do is use that money to leverage volunteer translation resources around the world, and to take the core documents that we devise having to do with membership and make them accessible in other languages. So those are the deliverables. I would encourage all of you to read the foundation as a grant proposal because it fleshes out to some degree the bylaws changes that were just enacted by the board. So one more thing that I want to do before I turn it back over to Greg is to provide a little bit more context in the various conversations that I've been having and in the membership meeting we had the other day and in my conversations with some of the people that have been founded by Marco. There's a degree of misconception about the indirect election method that the board adopted, and I want to just put the best possible spin on why the board did it that way. Recognizing that we have no monopoly on truth, but I think it may help to shape the discussion if I give a little bit of the context that brought us here and what we were thinking of. There were two big advantages that the board identified in an indirect election mechanism. They're both rooted, in essence, in the fact that ICANN is unlike a normal policymaking body, that it does have a single overriding substantive mandate, which is that above all else, ICANN must preserve the stability of the Internet resources that it's been entrusted with. And whatever structures we devise, through the supporting organizations, through at-large membership, they must operate in that context. They must be consistent with the basic mission to preserve the stability of these Internet resources. So, with that in mind, and recognizing that there is considerable nervousness among many parties about an untested global at-large election mechanism with planned mechanisms for verification, authentication, and so forth, but we've never tested it. So, in a context of anxiety and a basic substantive mission to preserve stability, the board thought that an indirect election mechanism has two sets of advantages. There's a third, which has been talked about a great deal, which has to do with derivative lawsuits. But I think, as the board discussed this in its open public meeting and so forth in Santiago, that was really ancillary to the fundamental advantages of on the merits. And they are as follows. First, the existing supporting organizations each have councils. The councils are essentially standing committees whose job it is to conduct policy review, to develop policy in a bottom-up process, and to provide expert opinion to the board of directors. The at-large membership doesn't have any such structure. Once it elects, the at-large membership without an at-large council doesn't have any such structure. Once it elects its directors, that's it. Its job is done. And the board thought that the at-large council could play a key, continuing, ongoing role in conducting outreach, managing the public comment flow in and out of ICANN and the ICANN board to individuals, and where appropriate, providing policy input. The board considered alternatives to come up with the same sort of advantages, but it was thought that some sort of an at-large council was the best way to do it. My exhaustion is now going to show as I try to struggle for the second cluster of reasons why this was an advantage. Does anybody remember the speech that I gave the other day? Can remind me of what it is. So at-large council.
Basically, the notion that they do more than just board of directors, they become an active group that is, in essence, it's the MAC, but it's an elected MAC. And, I mean, I would assume, let's be blunt, that some of the MAC members are going to be the kind of people who run for the at-large council membership.
I'm going to cluster that into the first one. I remembered what the second one is. The second group of advantages has to do with the basically promoting high-quality candidates for the board through deliberation. As Esther has pointed out in a bunch of different contexts, deliberation and thoughtful reflection is something to be encouraged, and having an at-large council that can itself deliberate on the best board members from among a pool of nominees from the membership is thought to be an advantage. ICANN is more likely to get higher quality board members that are more consistent with the overall mission of preserving the stable stability and operation of these technical resources that an at-large council allows people to think about it and to choose individuals that they, by consensus, agree on. Now, that's a debatable advantage. There's some people who think that they've looked at the DNSO Names Council election process and perceived a number of problems with the way it works and don't want to replicate that in the at-large membership size. So, in any event, those are the two clusters of advantages to this on the merits that the board thought adhered in an at-large membership council. So with that, I will turn it back to you.
Thank you, Andrew. In Santiago, the decided to establish an implementation task force to assist the chief executive in the work, considerable work that needs to be done to get the membership up and running. And there's been some input to that from members of the old MAC. I think it's best that Mike Roberts, who will have the responsibility for this, perhaps speaks to the formation of the ITF.
Thank you, Greg. The hope in Santiago was that our progress towards funding would have proceeded somewhat more rapidly than it has, but at any rate, we've now arrived at the point where Marco has funded our proposal, and so we will be working very aggressively to recruit a program manager. One of the primary responsibilities of that person is to be a staff to the membership implementation task force. The task force would really be substantially hindered in its work if there was no there at ICANN to provide necessary staff liaison coordination, a place where suggestions actually got received and something got done about them. We have, within the past 30 days, put up ICANN's own computer facilities, and we're now in a position to begin to support with the usual array of web and email tools, an effective interaction task force, and we'll be, putting that together rapidly. The staff recommendation to the board today with regard to at large is that the board call for nominations for members of the implementation task force, and that there be a balance between people who have the corporate, very valuable corporate memory of participation in the MAC, along with people who are fresh, have new insights, lots of energy, lots of regional diversity in their backgrounds and their interests. It is if it's not entirely clear for people who weren't in Santiago, one of the primary responsibilities of the implementation task force members is to participate in the outreach program that gets us a strong, diverse, numerous, geographically balanced at-large membership cohort signed up and ready to go to get on with the job of electing the first wave of council members. There are lots of details about how to conduct fair and open and verifiable elections. We're still in input mode on that subject, and as any of you have had an opportunity to read the releases about the other Marco grants from the other day are aware, we're now going to be the beneficiaries of some extremely professional advice on this matter. Having said that, I think it's essential to emphasize that nobody's trying to do what we're about to try to do, and so any advice we get about the best way of doing it has to be measured against the fact that it hasn't been done before. By way of of soliciting your input, and we certainly look to anybody and everybody that's been part of the ICANN family over the past year or so to help us with this. Several people have commented to me about the issue of how ICANN might struggle with great success in our membership program. It's the range of opinions on how many at-large members we will get is extremely diverse. Clearly, we are in a position to deal very, very effectively and rapidly with numbers in the low thousands. On the other hand, if there's some reality to a projection that we might find a couple hundred thousand or more than that coming to our website, filling out our membership application and starting the cycle of verification of residency and so on, that's a considerable challenge to us, and one that we're not entirely capable of dealing with at the moment. So I'm certainly on behalf of the staff going to be looking at what do you do, how do you handle success squared in our outreach program. Thank you. I think we should go into questions and comments from the audience at this stage, yes.
And maybe someone from the MAC wants to just start off with what they are proposing. That would be helpful.
Thank you, sir. My name is Ethan Yais. I'm one of the MAC members, or retired MAC members at Berlin. The six of the retired MAC members, Diane Kevel from Kanchana, Siegfried Langenbacher, Nick Wainor, Otto Bless, and myself, happen to be here in LA. And we made up some proposal for the task force if the board will take this and as well as this staff. I wouldn't go too much into details, and I hope that this will be posted sometime soon by you or government, but we basically recommend to have 10 representatives for the new task force, two from each region. Hopefully half will be recruited from the original MAC and half will be a new block, and added two of the ICANN directors and additional task force chair and ICANN staff to work out mainly six areas we see important. One is election mechanics. The second one is criteria for fair election. What is fair, we should perhaps define. The third one is very important, outreach. The fourth one is campaign, to recommend ground rules for campaigns. What would be the appropriate debate forum, things like that. The fifth one is nomination procedures. And the sixth is the function of the large council itself. Of course, it should be decided by the elected large councils themselves in the end, but it might be better to give some idea what you're supposed to do when you're elected as a large council in advance. We'll foresee some of the teleconference meetings and possible some physical meetings to carry this out. That's the essence of our proposal. Okay.
So, I mean, Greg, this sounds very similar to the ITF that you're... Funny coincidence.
Yes, it is, in fact, a suggested structure and... terms of reference for the ITF, and I would recommend that this be taken by Mike as to put to his deliberations and how he forms the ITF.
We're certainly welcoming comments at this point, and there are two online comments, and are you pointing to, to Amadeo. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll do the online.
Thanks. I've been saying since Singapore that I think that all this membership issue answers is a very good answer to the wrong question. The question being how we select good directors. I still believe that, but I take note that nobody, including me, has came forward with a better proposal. And we need the mechanisms to select members urgently. So, you know, even if you have lots of reserves, it's worth a try. The question here is, that learning from the past, if we take the SO elections, you see that, and I don't mind acknowledging that because I'm one of them, you see the other the ASO and the PSO have produced an incredibly high-value representative slate of nominees and directors, while the DNSO has made good choices. But it's not exactly the same. With all due respect to Alex and Jonathan, and especially me, we are not as representative of our incoming supporting organization as Pinder, Vinserv, Phil Davidson, and the rest of them. And it doesn't mean that we will not do a similar good job here. It means that there were some kind of, let's say, political constraints that made a strange and difficult process. And this can be even more difficult because the electorate was the Names Council, a group of people with clear interest and clear interest in making this moving forward and with clear commitments here. Well, we are electing something that's very vague, very abstract. The only goal is electing people. And we should think about that. And what I would just ask is two things. The first one is that we establish some kind of evaluation period just after the first election to see what we need to change. So we don't commit to the whole process on the road without any change. We reevaluate the procedures, at least, after the first selection. And the second one is something that worries me because I should confess that I fail to understand. The regional diversity. It's very clear for me on the election of the at-large council, but I fail to see what are the concrete rules for the selection of directors. And here, I would suggest that we need to make sure in the bylaws or in the electoral proposal that they have to elect at least one representative of each region, and I would propose that we go in the reverse order of the results of the ESO selection. That is, in ESOs were Europe 4, North America 3, Asia 1, Latin America 1. Here should be first Africa, Latin America, Asia Pacific, North America, and Europe, in that complete order.
Andrew, you had a specific comment on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, actually, the way that the bylaws work now, the basic geographic diversity rules for the board on the at-large side are that there must be one from each region and four that are elected globally at-large, or that can become from any region. The structure for the at-large council is that you simply double that. And you say that there are two of 18 from each region and then eight that are elected globally at large. So the fundamental rules are already in place. And I'm sorry, what was your first
question? Sorry,
the review period. And I should also say, the at-large membership bylaws call for a two-stage election process where if we've got nine directors to elect, 18 at-large council members to elect, the first stage of the election is to elect six at-large council members and then review. And at that point, the board has to approve the fairness and all of that of the results. And if they approve it, those six can then elect three directors, and then you do a second election for the other 12 council members, and then everybody chooses the remaining six board members. So there's a phase-in process in order to run it once, see how it works, run it again. And indeed, we specified that two of the first six at-large council members be elected regionally, one from Africa, one from Latin America, in order to ensure.
Okay.
Yeah, well, just to clarify that point, the at-large directors, as they are selected, will be replacing the initial directors, and the initial directors do not have representatives from Africa or Latin America, and so that among the first and large directors selected, there must be a representative from Latin America and a representative from Africa.
Actually, if anyone can read it, it is actually at the council level. Maybe this is something the board wants.
Exactly. We need
to note the question. The bylaws that were passed with the footnote that they're all subject to review over the coming period says that you get at least one Latin American, one African on the at-large council in the first round of elections.
And then the directors follow de facto. Geraldine, then two at-large, two online cuts, and then Eric and Teresa.
I think it's clear that at the board organization, it's the geographic diversity warranted by the bylaws. But what we are doing now is discussing about the at-large membership and the geographic diversity of the membership itself, how it is selected, how it's going to work to nominate the directors is another issue. And I think that on this we have to improve what is has been done now. You know.
One way we can hope to do that is by getting foundations from outside the U.S. to try and beat Marple's generosity and also their involvement. The online comments.
Our first comment is from Mark Langston, and his comment is, the bylaw requiring all nine of the at-large board members to become inactive if the membership drops below 5,000 is a dangerous rule, which allows a large group to have an effective tool for manipulating the composition of the ICANN board by directing their membership to withdraw from the at-large body. The disenfranchisement of the at-large body by excluding them as members of ICANN and requiring the selection of an at-large executive committee who will then choose the at-large board members smacks of yet another top-down organization and takes away any legitimacy the at-large body would have as an effective body within ICANN. This at-large body cannot stand as a substitute for a constituency of individual stakeholders. Domain name holders are not equal to passive consumers of the Internet, and it's wrong to assume that their interests will be addressed by any such diluted body. The second comment is from Dennis Schaefer. Why would any individual pay dues to belong to an organization for the sole purpose of electing an unknown representative who will in turn elect board members? Trade associations and professional groups can easily afford to pull members in this way and indeed have an interest in doing so. This membership technique threatens to tilt elections and decisions in top-down mode. Please correct this bias to ensure parity for individuals.
Greg, I know you thought about these both.
Yes, the issue of the composition of the membership and the way in which they go about elections has been a matter that the membership advisory committee has thought long and hard about. We believe that we need essentially simple rules, but we are very pleased that the Markle Grant has offered the support of a number of prestigious groups to advise us on these matters, and we'll be looking for their advice as we go forward.
Yeah, but I think we had looked at this issue of the 5,000 inactive and so forth, and I think the purpose of having the at-large council and the outreach is so that these are not unknown nominees but known ones.
If I could just comment on that, the bylaw structure. Nobody gets kicked off anything if there's fewer than 5,000 members. What happens is a term expires and the corporation is not in a position to hold an election until it gets those 5,000 members. So, you know, it's basically a predicate to the holding of an election that there be enough people that the result be at least minimally, provide at least minimal assurance that it's not easily vulnerable to capture.
Eric's case.
Hold on. Greg, this is a question for clarification on one of your earlier slides. You had a bullet that stated something to the effect that the membership was going to have to redo after each election. As much as in the first year, there will be two tranches of election, are you actually contemplating that the first 5,000 will have to renew prior to the second group of elections for the remainder of the at-large council?
No, in fact, I think that the statement referred to the process when we're in the continuous phase of annual elections in which three of the at-large directors are replaced or re-elected in each year. You're quite right. For the first year, with it occurring in two tranches, then I think the one would not restart the membership list from scratch after the first election. You would keep those members in place to go forward because they are elected or that they have joined to participate in the election of all of the at-large councillors and the at-large directors, not just the first three, so that that particular situation wouldn't apply for those 2 points. And in fact, my own view is that it might even stay in place, the membership would stay in place and not retire until the first at-large council re-election. That is, so that on the basis that people joining near the close period for the second part of the first year's elections would then have another 12 months of participation and another election before we restart the list.
Great.
morning, Teresa Amato. I just want to present some concerns, and maybe they're more appropriate for the task force that's going to be developed, but there's questions as it's swirling around, and I'd like to just put them on the record. Is there going to be some kind of mechanism that would prevent one large company or organization from being able to submit all of their members to the membership without having some kind of affirmative opt-in from those individuals? And will the task force address that kind of question? Second, not sure because the terms have been used somewhat interchangeably. Is it an appointment process from the at-large council to the board, or is it an election process from the at-large council to the board, such that there's going to be some kind of voting mechanism? And what will that voting mechanism exactly be? Third, if you are a candidate for the at-large council, do you get access to the membership list of the organization so that you can effectively campaign, and what kind of restrictions will there be on that? Fourth, beyond Markle Foundation, I know there's some concern from folks around the world. Is there, are there other foundations that have been identified that have been already applied to in terms of some kind of outreach? And five, what if the new folks that have been funded by the Markle Foundation come back with suggestions that may suggest that the current bylaws is adopted, for example, that two phases of election are not the best process? Would the board be willing to re-examine the bylaws before the first election is conducted? Thank you.
Just a couple of comments. The view of the MAC, and I agree, is that what is hopefully a very large membership and globally distributed, one should not try, and it would be almost impractical to put restrictions on the members, so that there would be nothing to prevent all of the members of one corporation enrolling as members for the purposes of electing the council. However, the bylaws restrict to the number of councillors from any one organisation in a similar manner to the restrictions that are applied on SO council members, so that their opportunity to have very large representation on the council is very restricted. The other points you raised, I think, are, as you suggested correctly, for the implementation task force to consider. And you're quite right, they are very important issues and they need a lot of consideration.
The only other issue is, have we applied to other foundations? And outside the U.S., I believe no, we have not. And that is a failure of ability to round up the time, resources, names, et cetera.
What we have done is we've sent around the proposal to a number. With most foundations, what you do is you approach them first with a letter of inquiry, and then you see if they come back to you, and then you go back and forth. This is what we did with the Markle Foundation. You go back and forth a bunch of times. We started that. Nothing to show for it so far, and I think you were right that none of them are outside the U.S.
And so the point I'm trying to make is that if anybody can suggest to us a foundation we should approach, and beyond that, if anybody has a relationship with that foundation and they can help us to approach it, we would very gratefully use your help and support in doing that. And that's especially to people outside the U.S.
And I wanted to make just one point in response to Teresa's first question about capture by a large corporation. That is exactly the fear. That is exactly precisely what concerns those of us that have done staff work on this, is that never having done this before, and noting that if you look out into the internet, there are companies and other organizations with both the incentive and the financial resources to really try to do something like that. Exactly. That's what makes everybody nervous, and that's what essentially underpins both an indirect structure and a phased election structure, so that you provide some confidence. There are other ways to do it. I mean, one way that we talked about and ultimately did not adopt, but was to have a nominating committee that screens candidates. You would have a direct election straight to the board, but you would have a nominating committee that would essentially cabin the range of people that could be voted on. But there you get into all kinds of legitimacy problems about who's the nominating committee and how do they get chosen and who gives them any legitimacy to say who can and can't be a candidate. So that's one structure that a number of organizations use. We tried it a different way. But it's an excellent point, and it's what's been motivating a lot of our thinking on this. Amadeus?
I have strong weight glasses, I need to like bring me to the room to have another pair.
Cam is coming to...
Yeah, I have just a comment to make, and this is a purely personal comment, but is in relation to the Mark Foundation and the associated entities that issued press releases during the course of the event and afterwards. I read those press releases, and to be frank, you know, this whole process has been very difficult at best. And to bring in other issues, which you can read the press releases, I'm sure you'll know what they are, I think it really should not be part of the ICANN process per se. And we're here and we've got a job, and to further geopoliticize it or add other values or value systems to it is probably inappropriate.
It's been a perpetual fight. This group is remarkably quiet, both up here and down there.
Wolfgang Seidlich, I have a very minor question. You know, we have the principle of geographical diversity. Yesterday, small and medium businesses were asking for representation in the board. But what about the principle of gender diversity in the initial board? There were 3 women, but among the 9 new directors, there were only men. You know, how to guarantee that we have a board which is not 100% only of men? It's a minor question, but maybe we should think also this into consideration.
Let's take note of that and
change.
Is everybody out there happy with how we're going forward with this? Because do we need to talk about the bylaws? Okay, well, let's do, I mean, if there's really nothing more to do, we will close this and then we will start the board meeting. If we should talk about the bylaws and potential changes to them, let's do that. And Kent has a question.
Well, let's finish the membership discussion. But before we move on to that, I would like to at least say a few more words on a couple of other topics. We had an agenda item yesterday we didn't get to, which was the offer for any comments on other issues. And I know a couple of people who aren't here today, and I will say a couple of words on those. It won't take long.
Okay. Let's do the at-large membership. Then Bob Connolly. And Ken is absolutely right. We forgot to do, in the press of excitement, we forgot to do the other comments on interest, on matters other than at-large membership or NSI. So, who is next? Sorry, forgive me. Kilman.
Yes, so this is a question to the group. The space establishment. First of all, could you tell me schedule more in detail? Like a first 6 council member and 3 board member will be elected in June. The last one by September. There seems to be something in between 3 and 6 more. And the second is a more fundamental question. Why do you want to have this space establishment? Implication is that first 6 people. Like my interpretation is correct, the first 6 people elect the 3 board member. Why not 18 member elect the 6? There must be some reasoning. It seems to be usually 6 people elect 3, then next time 12 people elect 3 more. Why you have to go through this process? I mean, there has to be some reasoning, which I'm not really convinced, but I don't know. I may be missing something. So can you explain on the just idea your approach?
This comes about through the decision to phase the introduction of the at-large council and the at-large directors in 2 steps, with two objectives in view. One is that we wish to review the process and to be satisfied that it is satisfactory and meets all of the criteria for success that we will establish. But also, we would like to have a phase-in and phase-out of the new directors. In other words, we felt that if all of the initial at-large directors retired in one fell swoop and were replaced by the newly selected directors, then there would be a loss of continuity, which could be valuable to the board, so that that produced the reasoning of having six at-large councillors initially elected who would select the first three directors, and when that was demonstrated as a successful process, we would complete the process as soon as possible. I think your first question related to the scheduling. Yes, I outlined a very broad schedule. I have sort of ideas in much finer detail than that, but I think that it will only be when we have a staff member working in the detail of it that we'll really boil that down to a day-by-day flowchart to produce the result we need by September.
Okay,
can I just add something to that in response to your question, Tona? At least the way that I've been thinking about this, the reason for phased election is to build confidence. It's to test, review, audit, and build confidence. And if you notice in the bylaws, it requires that the board elect the first six as a test group and then review. Look at the process, look at the membership roles that elected them, look at how the process works, and then if they approve the process, those six get to elect three directors. But that's kind of secondary. The reason to elect three directors is just to get some number of at-large directors on the board to let some of these existing directors get off the board and then to go forward. And so what we did was we just did it proportionally. We said, well, you elect first, that's one-third, and so we'll have them choose one-third of the at-large directors. There's no science to it, but in my view, it was in essence a confidence-building measure.
Okay. So do you want to test your system?
Yeah.
Okay.
Operations research professor, I'm sure you can.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have two online comments. We have Ken Kuke over there.
We actually, at this point, we have one because the previous comment was addressed while we were waiting. This is from Ward Goodwin. What checks and balances are there on a board of directors to protect the public if they start to break their own bylaws and change the rules in ways that enhance their control over sections of the global internet?
The Independent Review Committee, which is about to begin doing its job and address some of these complaints. Ken Kuke.
The U.S. Small Business Administration has been saying over the course of the last few days that ICANN is bound by regulations that are based in the United States by means of the MOU that was signed with the Department of Commerce, so therefore. Okay, sorry. I'll repeat that. The U.S. Small Business Administration has been saying over the last few days that ICANN is bound by regulations from the United States due to the fact that ICANN's justification for the moment has been created through the MOU with the Department of Commerce. My first question is that true? Is that in fact the case that ICANN, to your knowledge, is bound by such regulations? The second question, of course, is that ICANN was created so that it could be somewhat insulated from such concerns. And the third thing is, if this is in fact the case, and of course your door is open to other such international regulations, like from the WTO, how do you think that ICANN can prevent itself from getting into such a situation in which a lot of different institutions from other jurisdictions try to impose their principles on your operating procedures?
Okay, Ken. They wrote us a letter that is public. We're going to give them an answer in public, which is going to include our lawyer's opinion on that issue. Vis-a-vis other organizations such as the WTO, we do not have a memorandum of understanding with them and do not intend to, as far as I know. So,
I think your interpretation of the SBA's comment is just wrong, actually.
But anyway, we'll look at the letter carefully. Our counsel will figure out what the legal requirements are, but I think we all agree that we have no problem, and we have indeed a fair amount of process in place, and the board is happy to look again at whether the timelines suggested impose any undue difficulties. Okay. Teresa, Tony, and then we would like to leave 10 minutes to do Ken and Bob Connolly.
I doubt it. It's not on membership.
Oh, right.
Okay. Open question.
Well, then let's. Tony, are you on membership or something else? Okay.
Can I respond to the last recommendation or the last comment that was made? Good morning. My name is Eric Mingy. I am Office of Advocacy at the United States Baltic Administration. I have to agree with Andrew. I think our letter did not precisely say what Mr. Cookie said. It said, but we said that the Department of Commerce is bound by U.S. law. ICANN, because of the nature of the MOU, has certain, as yet undefined, duties to, we believe, that should comply with that. We do not say that ICANN is bound by U.S. law, but we think that the duties the Department of Commerce has should in some way come through to ICANN. Now, as I was speaking with Mr. Pescate later, we believe that other country laws are just as applicable as the United States, and anything that the ICANN does should take into account the laws and procedures of other nations just as much as the United States.
Thank you for the clarification. Is this a membership question?
Yep.
Why don't you come up?
It's a question for Andrew. This is a follow-up question. I'm sorry, my name is Joyce Lynn. Regarding your concern about the, Joyce Lynn, regarding your concern about some companies that have resources, financial resources, or the intention to capture the board, is there any provision that the board has that when this kind of intention is detected, that the members can be stripped of the membership or the company will be suspended from participation in this board?
The way that the board came up to deal with this is that it is a phased election process where you elect six members, and if it turns out that it's six people, all of whose address and employer are located in a certain suburb of Washington, D.C., then maybe the board wouldn't accept the result. So that's the idea. And it's basically the idea that you use running code. You know, you test and you see the results, and then you go forward if it works. But there is no specific provision that says this is the test of capture, and this is how you define it, and if it happens, then you block the election process. It just simply says the board uses its judgment and exercises judgment based on the results of the first test round of elections.
Yeah, I'd like to, in case there's any confusion on this point, because the MAC did go back and forth on the issue of whether there was going to be an organizational membership permitted in at large, and the board's decision on that is that this is an individual membership. So people who are signing up, presumably are signing up as individuals, giving their home address and contact information and that sort of thing. Now, that certainly means that they could be told at work to do it. And that's why demographic analysis of where the residency will be part of the verification work that's done. There are, of course, real limits on both the fairness and our ability to detect what someone's employer might be when what we're looking at is a home address.
Thank you. We're now going to move to the open comment period. We're going to start with Kent Fossler with a couple of comments from yesterday, then Bob Connolly, and then Teresa Kern, and any board members.
Thank you. Yes, my comment kind of related from conversation with John Kern, who's the chair of ARIN, which actually reminded me that in my introduction yesterday, I failed to associate myself and explain that I had been on the ARIN board for a year and was treasurer of ARIN, and during that process came to appreciate the very difficult challenge and responsibility that these regional registries have, and especially I think ARIN with the broad region it covers and the challenges in the United States. Having said that, I think what John wanted to bring to our attention and has, and I just wanted to make sure it was publicly acknowledged, that there are some issues and discussions over legacy addresses that hopefully would get corrected or clarified in a number of ways, perhaps through the contractual arrangement. other specific housekeeping details as to what I am on a day-to-day basis. And those are healthy discussions, and a lot of us want to acknowledge that. The other point, and I don't know if these representatives would be to acknowledge that there are two new areas developing their own registries, and we've had a lot of discussion on those, Latin America and Africa, and that according to the ASO MOU, it's the ICANN board's responsibility to, at some point in time, recognize those registries through checking against criteria. And as that develops, before they get actually recognized, to recommend and appoint some observers to the ASO. In order for us to do that, we acknowledge we need the recommendations and input from the ASO, and those conversations are going on. But I wanted those regions to know that we know and the processes are underway.
Can I add to that? I mean, yeah, we also need the criteria for which the RARs, the new RARs, to be set. That should be responsibility by the council.
Yes, I wanted to just footnote that this is an area the staff has discussed, and we're very aware of a whole list of legacy issues here. I get a lot of comment about conservation of IPV4 space and why there's some entities, especially entities located in the U.S., have so much address, V4 address space without any reason for it. It is alleged. So I think that in a world of deployment of IPV6, the whole issue of conservation of the legacy space needs another, and for that matter, reservation in the new space needs a good hard look at.
Thanks.
Hello. Last night when I stepped out the front door of the hotel, I was approached by a stranger who said, "Are you Mr. Connolly?" I said I was, and the stranger said, "I'm serving a process on you," and handed me an envelope. I said, "You must be kidding." He replied, "No, I'm not," and walked away. Opened the envelope, I found a complaint from someone who thinks he owns a certain undelegated GTLD. I don't think ICANN needs any more reasons to prohibit delegation of any new commercial registries for GTLDs.
Thank you. Okay. Teresa. Hi, Teresa Amato, Citizen Advocacy Center and Consumer Project on Technology. I have a question about access to information of ICANN documents. And I know that the bylaws provide for openness and transparency to the extent feasible. But a question came up. There was a comment, or I believe it was somebody from the European Union, said that a letter had been sent to ICANN. Is there a way that the public can ask through some kind of procedure to obtain information that is sent to ICANN, and would the board please contemplate some kind of policy where people will be able to have access to ICANN documents? Thank you.
Which letter in specific, is this the letter that is non-existent because we didn't receive it?
Well, let me just say that we live in an electronic world. We get a lot of communications that have various degrees of an official look to them. For instance, people will put their logo in a formal postal address on an email and send it to us. So I think that rather than getting into the question of what's a letter, it's more appropriate for us to look at the matter of what is the content of the communication. Deal with a matter that comes under our cognizance? Is it something the staff believes the board will need to act on? Anything that satisfies the requirements of the board's bylaws with regard to policy matters is routinely made part of the public record.
Maybe, Dan, can you pull up a browser?
And post it. It's not just a record.
Go to ICANN.org and then correspondence. So, just as a webmaster, one of the joys of this job has been learning how to well, learning how not to do a website and then trying to figure out how to make it right. But when we get stuff in and it's something that rises to the level of board action, I almost always stick it up here. Sometimes people send letters not in electronic form, shockingly enough, and that means that we have to scan it, and that sometimes is a delay. But, yeah, I mean, we try to post everything, but as you can imagine, Diana gets tons of day-to-day routine correspondence, some of which just wouldn't be fair to put out on the web because it's ongoing, you know, discussions with people to try to work out problems and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, probably we should put more out rather than less, and I'll make a personal commitment to try to be more timely and so forth.
Well, what I was suggesting is not, I don't care about any particular one letter or not, but I was suggesting having a more formal procedure for, as opposed to somebody exercising discretion of whether or not this is substantive or important to so-and-so, but there's some kind of formal mechanism by which the public can access information that is sent to ICANN or that is generated by ICANN, but that somebody did not necessarily determine significant enough to put up on the web page. So that's really the question. Thank you.
The question is, judging the importance of a letter unfortunately requires human discretion because you can't count the number of words. If it's something that requires action, if it's something that requires response by Mike or me, we will post it. If it's somebody complaining because they weren't in Whois or something, we usually don't post it. We forward it to NSI. And
we get a huge number of letters that say, "Dear ICANN, please give me the following top-level domains at your earliest convenience." So, you know, a lot of that stuff we just know. But I mean,
not arbitrary. It is discretion.
Tony Rakowski, sort of representing the...
Let Teresa just have her last word. She, okay. I think, wanted to...
Well, actually, this is mental telepathic. I'm sorry. Exactly.
I don't mean that every communication needs to be posted. My question is, if I was concerned about a particular communication, could I make a formal request letter of some sort or an inquiry to the board and ask for that particular information? Or if, say, I wanted to see all the taxi receipts or something like that, I'm drawing an analogy here to U.S. information law, but I know other countries in the world have access to information procedures, and I know that they typically apply to public bodies. The question for ICANN is, would you contemplate a procedure like that where there's some kind of mechanism by which people may consider the information insignificant, but somebody considers it significant and would like to have access to see it? That's the question.
I think what Teresa Amato is suggesting is not unlike the suggestion from the Small Business Association administration. In both cases, the procedural mechanisms are ones that apply to the government. I think in our response to that, we can both benefit from what's the purpose behind those, how do they work, what's good about them, what's problematic about them. And the other part of the question is, in what way are we like a government, and in what way are we not? And I think that's a useful conversation for us to have within the board. I think I also hear Teresa saying, not that you reject judgment and understand that we have to employ some kind of judgment, but like the Small Business Administration, you're saying, could you make these procedures, the criteria, a little more explicit so that we in the public can know what's legitimate to ask for and expect to be responded to. Okay, Tony.
Frankly, I was going to make exactly the same point. I think Teresa made it quite well. In this particular instance, it was a communication from the European Union concerning the applicability of their privacy laws to the Whois databases, so it was clearly very important and very relevant to everybody. And communications like that certainly should receive some sort of notice.
Based on your description of it, you're right. And yeah. But I don't know about that letter.
Yeah, we've had discussions with several of the commission directors going back to the formation of ICANN, since it's a matter of considerable interest to members of the board. And the state of play on that is that, in fact, we're going to have some further discussions in Europe in 2 weeks about this. The commission has a version of the same difficulty we have here in the United States with regard to this matter, and that is how to balance, as was very cogently said yesterday, the needs for public access to information that involves law enforcement or similar public needs versus rights for protection of personal privacy. There are very few, if any, black and white answers to that, and not only with regard to where the Commission is on this matter, but with regard to where United States law is on this matter. We've had a considerable discussion, argument about it just this summer in the United States Congress. People are searching for that balance to the extent that obviously anything that ICANN does, it needs to be lawful, and it indeed will be lawful. So we don't legislate anything that affects the operation of national laws. We will certainly, as we get into this, and with substantial discussion on the issue of privacy with regard to the first section of the WIPO report, where the board adopted language in the accreditation guidelines after considerable public comment last March, that dealt with the board's notion of balance on this issue as of last March on the specific set of requirements that were needed to put companies into the business of competing for the assignment of domain names. So it's a matter of continuing interest, and we will, of course, since it is clearly a policy matter for us affecting things like who is databases, you'll be hearing a lot more about it.
And if we can find the letter, we should post it. I don't know. But, I mean, it's clear, based on that description, that's the kind of correspondence we should be posting. There's a final comment from online.
This is a comment from Thomas Lowenhaupt. A recurrent theme expressed by the ICANN has been that its role is a very limited one. To those who've shown immense concern over a perceived lack of openness and democratic process, the ICANN response has been, it's just names and numbers, what are you getting so excited about? To those who have seen the ICANN evolving into a general governance body, the response has been, world government, us, what have you been smoking? After a year of operation, what internet functions have you found to be outside the scope of the ICANN's charter? Are these functions in need of governance? If so, what mechanisms would board members feel appropriate to provide this oversight, coordination, governance? What role will the ICANN play in detailing and fostering their implementation? And if not ICANN, which organization would initiate these? Commerce or Congress? Sincerely, Thomas Lowenhaupt.
This sounds like a great essay question for any board member who wants to. I mean, seriously, if anybody, especially among the new members, would like to comment. Rob?
I think the short version of the answer is no. We do names, numbers, and protocols, and unless we have that in order, we are not going to contemplate World Cup.
Anyone have any other response? Other than what? Me? Okay. Yes.
There are lots of issues, privacy, taxation, that we don't deal with at all. I mean, you could make a whole list. I don't understand the point.
No, yeah. That's what I said. This is an essay question. As a director, you do not want to do this through ICANN. Where do you see it being done?
I think it's fair to say, though, that all of our deliberations have been around the establishment of the organization, bylaws, and the three fundamental pillars of our charter that we just named. And I think you could make a fairly long list of other issues about the internet that we don't deal with and have to. Amadeo says, besides that, we have brilliant ideas about them.
Yeah, I just want to add to my previous comment with respect to the Markle Foundation and other interests and their perception of us,
yeah,
as opposed to our perception of ourselves. I think it's very important that at some point, as far as how we project ourselves
would clarify is that we don't receive questions like this. Suffice to say that those who want to draw us, paint us as this kind of a governance body, I think if we take a proactive step and just concentrate on what we're supposed to do over time, we should very clearly, not have these types of questions.
Well, I mean, if you look at this question as a sincere question, my answer would be, I agree these are very important things, and in fact, as a member of the board of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is an appropriate organization to deal with them, I'm quite active.
Right.
And, you could treat this question as a, hey, board members, tell us more about yourself. Do you care about these issues outside of ICANN, and if so, where are you dealing with them? It can be perceived as not an attack, but a genuine...
Well, I think to clarify that, there's appropriate forums, but for those issues, it's not here.
Right. Jonathan.
Well, at the risk of sounding like Pinky in the Brain, for those of you who are cartoon watchers, it seems to me it is a legitimate question. I mean, however it's phrased, or however it's intended, and that is, while there are those who are clearly concerned about ICANN not exceeding certain parameters of authority or dealing in areas where it's not required, I'm not sure that there is a clear picture to many people in the community about how some of these very important issues are going to be dealt with, and I don't think it's for us to decide whether the ICANN process is the right process, but perhaps it is for some. Perhaps it isn't. I don't know.
I think it's pretty clear in our bylaws that it is not. Ken?
Well, just going to comment, since the way you put it was, do we have any advice or comment, or some of us involved in my small business role as a one-person consultant for the last few years, I have been tracking and working on a number of issues. I've consulted with the Canadian government, with some telcos, with some small enterprises, the associations of freedom on the internet, all of those issues. And there are many of them, and there are lots of them going on, and there are many discussions going on in Geneva through United. There's lots going on if we can help people, but it's more an individual situation. I don't think it's an ICANN.
Honestly, we can give pointers to the other groups, the more appropriate forum.
Yeah, we can give pointers to the other groups, such as a number of the Markle organizations, for example, note very carefully that we are not the only organization that Markle is giving money to, and they're fostering democracy in other places. And frankly, I would invite them to give a grant to EFF. Anyway, let's close this off. I think it's time to have our break. And then we invite you all to come back and observe the board meeting. That is participation among ourselves. There will not be four mics at that point. Thank you all very much, and thank you for coming.